It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. It's President's Day, and on a day like today, our thoughts turn to Washington and Jefferson and Lincoln, possibly Roosevelt, both of them, and Kennedy. Perhaps the last president you might think of today is Calvin Coolidge, president of the United States from the time of Warren G. Harding's death in 1923 until 1929, the year that ushered in the Great Depression. Mr. Coolidge was a man of so few words that he earned the nickname Silent Cal. And when he died in 1933, Dorothy Parker famously asked, "How could you tell?" Writer Amity Schlaes has written a biography of Calvin Coolidge called Coolidge, which has made the New York Times bestseller list. She is also the chairman of the Coolidge Presidential Foundation, and she joins us now by phone. Amity Schlaes, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Good day.
What is there to say about a man who, some say, said nothing?
Well, one doesn't want to break the tradition, but a lot. People think because Coolidge said little, Silent Cal, that he was worth little. And we at the Coolidge Foundation and I, through my research, have discovered that Coolidge is a wonderful president, a model for modern Americans.
A model for modern Americans. How would this quaint, almost Victorian man have been a model for a modern president? What would there be for a politician today to take from his example?
Well, the number one thing that Americans are looking for is to cut the budget and balance the budget. They're concerned that no government can do that. Even if you're concerned about defense, you want to have a strong household at home. Coolidge actually cut the budget. He didn't merely reduce the increase like Ronald Reagan. He cut the budget even as he lifted burdens upon business and individuals. Some people, and this is actually, we can talk about this in partnership with Andrew Mellon. He really understood that when there were lower tax rates, you might get more business activity. And they cut the tax rate in Coolidge's era to 25%, the top rate, and they saw more business activity. That's amazing. They cut the tax rate, they balanced the budget. We don't think a politician is capable of that. And Coolidge wasn't of the time of Thomas Jefferson or Abraham Lincoln or Grover Cleveland, who's another less government model. He was pretty modern. You would have recognized him. This way of making him quaint, depicting him as a throwback, something out of a Victorian story, Dickens and so on, is a way of reducing him. He played to type for fun in the media. He was not unsophisticated, and he was a type, a New Englander, but he also was extremely sophisticated in the way he operated to achieve his end, which was to reduce government and honor the office of the presidency.
But some might say that, first of all, the circumstances of his presidency, the United States was not at war with anyone, and the United States was a very different country. This was nearly a century ago, and the federal government did not face the types of funding needs that we have today. I mean, it would seem that he was president at a time when perhaps you could look at paring down the government at the expense of adhering to the needs of certain segments of society, which we can get into later. But really, wasn't it a very different time that enabled him to do some of this?
Less different than alleged. For example, what you were alluding to, and that's important, is that today we have entitlements. That's the non-discretionary part of the budget, right? So we can cut defense, but we can't cut what? Social Security. It's hard to do in an annual budget. And since our entitlements are a large part of our budget, it's hard for us to cut the budget. That's the scenario that we have and that you were sketching. In that period, they didn't have so many entitlements. The government was small. In fact, the federal government was smaller taken together than the states and towns taken together as an economic presence. However, they did have big demands for entitlements. Two groups I come to mind for the Coolidge period, the 20s. Remember, coming out of World War I, the country was confused and often unhappy. A lot of soldiers came home. We had conscription. Many were disabled and forever. They didn't have antibiotics then. So if your leg was infected, well, they might cut part of it off, right? That's the way it went. And most households were a single earner. So imagine a household with a disabled vet and that's it, you know, for in terms of money. They were a strong voting group, the vets, and they wanted basically an entitlement. They wanted payments, a pension from the federal government.
Calvin Coolidge was vice president to Warren Harding, who was the president who denied benefits to these men who had served their country and, short of the ultimate sacrifice, had lost limbs and were disabled and could not work and earn a living. Why wouldn't you want to provide benefits to them?
Well, I think one has to be quite hard here and ask why wouldn't one, and not be embarrassed about appearing inhumane, because even free market people like Coolidge were quite humane, just humane in a different way. Of course, everyone wants to help wounded people. The question is whether the federal government should do it. And so, and even in the case of service, many of the states, that is military service, many of the states were stepping in. Charities at that time were much larger because the federal government was less in the charity business. Coolidge's argument, and you can see it in his vetoes, and you can see it in Harding's writing, was that if the federal government started to take care of senior citizens, it would never end. First, it would be the veterans, then it would be the general population, then it would be health care for the general population, then it would be disabled who were not senior. And that looks darn prophetic now, doesn't it? And it would run into a budget problem it could not address. There was a second group seeking rather large payments, whether you call them entitlements or not, from the period, and that was farmers. First, gee, farming did really well. They served the country in the war. They produced food. They were the breadbasket of Europe when the breadbasket of Europe was empty because of the war. And then the farming prices went down, the commodities went down, and the farmers couldn't afford their mortgages, and they were failing. And at that time, farmers were a huge share of the population. We can't even imagine it now because the country was still a good measure rural. And both these groups went at Coolidge and Harding before him and said, we want a regular payment. We're entitled. We're nice people, the reasons you sketched. We've certainly done service. And the federal government under Coolidge, and you want to say Harding before him, said no. And the economy benefited as a result because the economy had more freedom and it grew rather well. What is the most humane thing you can give a person who can work at all? A job. That's not a payment, a job. And in that sense, the 20s, with its more laissez-faire economy, was intensely humane. And Coolidge was well aware of it. He said, there's just some things that maybe the federal government can't do because we'll get on, modernly we'd say, a slippery slope into funding everything. And it seemed to work rather well. So it's a good model to study, especially the tax part vis-a-vis Andrew Mellon. Because Mellon and Coolidge had this wild idea that it came from Mellon's own experience in Pittsburgh about tax rates that it might be good to talk about for a minute.
Right. Well, let me just jump in because you mentioned something that comes up a lot in describing the presidency of Calvin Coolidge, and that is the laissez-faire government, which there are plenty of people who will agree with you on this, but there are also those who say that the federal government should be more involved in regulating and controlling the economy, and that the hands-off approach that Calvin Coolidge took to regulating Wall Street, to regulating businesses, is what paved the way for the Depression.
Well, there's scant evidence for that. Each decade is its own decade. If Coolidge were here, we're trying to be the proxy for Coolidge, right? We have to give Coolidge a chance to rebut. What Coolidge would say is, remember, at that time, they had no SEC. And they probably thought it was good there would be no Securities and Exchange Commission. Why? Because the market would know a lot about stocks. And if the stocks went too high, well, then they would crash. And people would learn that maybe stocks shouldn't go so high, what we call moral hazard. Or that they maybe shouldn't bet because people are adult, sentient beings. So Coolidge was definitely alarmed. He was not himself a stock market speculator. In fact, we have his portfolio, and we can see he was worried that the stock price would go too high and might go down because stocks doubled in this presidency and so on. In that period, they went to this number just after him, Hoover, 381, and he was accustomed to the stock market being, well, 150. That was alarming, and he knew it would come down, and he knew people would be upset. But he also knew from evidence in the past that the stock market crashed often, and usually the country survived. Coolidge's life about parallels the life of the Dow Jones Industrial Average, because he graduated college in the mid-1890s, and the Dow came online. And you can see any number of big crashes of the Dow without any gosh darn 10-year depression following. So in Coolidge's experience, a crash in the Dow was unfortunate, and one should be cautious, but it's not going to cause a national permanent seeming crisis. And Coolidge would have argued, people like him did, one thinks of the economist Benjamin Anderson, who was sort of the Paul Krugman of the day. he said, well, the reason this depression in the 30s is so long is because this time we're responding differently and intervening too much. So there's a whole argument about the 30s. I would rather stick to Coolidge and the 20s and look at the very strong growth in the 20s, which is not great Gatsby-ish in any way, the actual growth. You know, we like to look at patent data to see the quality of growth in the economy. The patent data of the 20s is through the roof. People had a lot of ideas, and they had good prospects for realizing them, and they trusted the economy. Trust is part of the economy, and it all worked. And many of those ideas helped the economy well into the 50s. Television, for example, was beginning to be an idea at companies like what we would know to be RCA. And this was coming on line because everyone was hopeful about the country and the prospects for growth.
Well, there was certainly the money to fund a lot of these things. We're talking with Amity Schlaes. She is the author of a biography of Calvin Coolidge, called Coolidge, and is with us now by phone on this President's Day. And Amity, could Calvin Coolidge have been elected president if he had not been on the ticket, if he had not been a vice president who was in an unfortunate circumstance where Warren Harding passed away? He took over, assumed the presidency, and then was reelected. But just based on his own personality, lacking some of the je ne sais quoi, as they say, could he have won on his own?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. The argument that he couldn't have won is that he was silent. As my grandmother would say, he wasn't telegenic. Of course, they didn't have television. But what she meant was, or one would mean, is he didn't charm a room. He didn't hold a room the way a charismatic like President Clinton would or President Reagan. He specialized in understatement. And a lot of us like that, but it's an acquired taste. You have to know why the person seems so quiet, right? However, on the other side, Coolidge was far better communicator than his reputation. For example, he was a radio president. We don't even know that because we don't have the tapes. We think of Roosevelt because we have the tapes as the great radio president. He was a radio president. He was on the radio quite often, and he was enormously popular. He was ranked among the top 10 or top 5 speakers in polls on the radio. He was intensely grateful for the radio because he tended to lose his voice after speaking on the hustings in the back of a train, right? They used to have give a lot of speeches before radio, and he would lose his voice. So when radio came along, he said, I am so fortunate about this. And he gave a few very important speeches. He had a New England accent, and it was said his voice cut like wire through the airwaves. People could hear it precisely. And I think Will Rogers, the comedian, also commented on this.
I want them to have the rewards of their own industry. This is the chief meaning of freedom. Until we can reestablish a condition under which the earnings of the people can be kept by the people, we are bound to suffer a very severe and distinct curtailment of our liberty.
Coolidge had enormous following in terms of sort of community aspects within the country. Example, he got the first Christmas tree, the national Christmas tree is what we call it now, and had it outside the White House at Christmas time. He wrote a great Christmas message to the country that was published all over the country and established the tradition of the presidential message. And he managed to do it very neatly because he didn't want to say the government runs Christmas. That's not American. He wanted to say the person who inhabits the White House, who is a statesman, sends his love and message to you. That is, he was able to navigate federalism and the role of faith in the country while inspiring everyone. Very hard to do. And in that sense, he did pave a path about how a president should act about faith in a country like ours.
Another little-known aspect of Calvin Coolidge's life is that he had a son, Calvin Jr., who suddenly died from sepsis due to an infected blister formed while playing tennis at the White House. This happened while he was campaigning for the presidency. Describe what this was like, how this impacted Coolidge, the president.
Well, if you have lost a child, any listener, or know someone who has lost a child, you know what it means. And we hope you come to Plymouth Notch, Coolidge's home, to go in the graveyard and see the little grave of the son near the grave of the father. Of course, it broke their life, their private life, to lose Calvin. We mentioned before there weren't antibiotics. the reason Calvin died was there weren't antibiotics. It's just full stop. It's blister. And he died very fast, within a week. The Coolidge later wrote that the joy of the presidency went away with the death of Calvin Jr. And that's very clear. It doesn't mean he became dysfunctional, but the joy of work went away, the glamour of the office. And it added to the simple fact of the death is the fact that Calvin Jr. was a charming guy. He was the life of the family. He was more open than C.C., the president. He's more like his mother, who was a lovely lady, and he was a great intelligence. You can see that in the things he wrote. He went to Mercersburg Academy in Pennsylvania, and there's still some materials of his there. He's much loved by the headmaster. So you not only lose the child, you lose the light of your life, and then the difficulty of the other son, John, who is a wonderful young man, but not so much a shining figure, no, not on first contact, and we all know what that's like. And then the burden on poor John of the death of his brother. But what I wrote in an essay I was recently working on was that this is a story not of yes, but of Coolidge failing because he lost his son and giving up in the presidency, and other biographers have suggested that. But yes, notwithstanding the terrible blow, Coolidge, like Lincoln, did persevere with his project, Civil War, Coolidge's project. Coolidge's war was economics. He was more like Lincoln in that. So we see the parallels. And by the way, Coolidge was well aware of them, that Lincoln had lost his son, where Lincoln's son had lain, and so on. And you can see the parallels even in the funeral arrangements.
We're talking with Amity Schlaes. She is the author of a biography of Calvin Coolidge, called Coolidge, and is with us now by phone on this President's Day. And Calvin Coolidge's wife, the First Lady, Grace Coolidge, she was proof that opposites attract, wasn't she?
Grace Coolidge was probably the most beautiful First Lady. She was as beautiful, some would say more beautiful, than Jackie Kennedy. Can you believe that? Why do I say that? She had a beautiful complexion. Every color looked good on her. There was a richness to it, a yellow in it that made green look great, that made rose look great, and so on. But mainly, she was incredibly kind and vivacious. So she wasn't just someone to look at and admire. She also, in every encounter, made the other person feel good. And here was Coolidge, the opposite. And interesting about Grace, she had a trade. She was someone who taught the deaf to speak. So she was used to drawing people out who had trouble and were shy and were inhibited. And that's just what she did. And then she drew the president out, and she entertained in the White House, and she worked for good causes, and she made every party happy. So you have First Ladies who are beautiful but less emotional and less don't connect so much to people. She was both beautiful and connected with everyone. So we don't want to undermine any other First Lady, but we want to give Grace the credit she deserved. There's a painting of her. Coolidge was quite jealous of her, by the way. That is, protective. He didn't really like her going on walks with other men, and even removed a Secret Service man who took her on too long a walk when they were in the Dakota Hills. That's a famous incident. So this was a passionate marriage of opposites, with many burdens and troubles, but in the end, a heroic and successful marriage.
Calvin Coolidge, there's more to the man than you might have thought, even though he was a man of few words, which earned him the nickname Silent Cal. Calvin Coolidge is the subject of the book by our guest, writer Amity Schlaes. It's called Coolidge, and it has appeared on the New York Times bestseller list. Amity Schlaes is the chairman of the Coolidge Presidential Foundation. Amity Schlaes, wish we had more time. Thank you so much for being with us today on this President's Day on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you.
Coming up, the strains of the tune Hail to the Chief are as familiar to Americans as the tune Yankee Doodle. But where did the song come from? We'll find out when Essential Pittsburgh's special President's Day edition continues on 90.5 WESA.
For the good old USA.